This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headley. It's the end of the spring semester on college campuses across the country. It's final season and commencement season, but many universities are preoccupied at the moment by sweeping protests against the war in Gaza. Students are forming encampments, occupying buildings, and being arrested in droves. So are professors and administrators, and yes, protesters from outside these university communities. Campus protests have polarized Americans for a very long time. They've also spurred change, both in public sentiment and in policy. Think of the Civil Rights Movement or the Vietnam War. But in a time when higher education is already in a precarious position in this country, are these protesters tipping the first domino in a chain of unintended consequences?
You, but certainly I, lived for 40 years of backlash that was precipitated in part by the protests on campuses in the late 1960s. And 40 years was an awful high price to pay.
Stephen Mintz joins Hear Me Out in just a moment. Stay with us.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headley. At the time of this recording, which is Friday, April 26th, students at college campuses all across the country are engaging in pro-Palestinian protests. Encampments have popped up at Columbia, Yale, Cornell, the University of Michigan, and dozens of others. Protesters have been arrested at least a dozen schools, including Ohio State, UT Austin, Emory, and the University of Southern California. USC has canceled its spring commencement ceremony because of what the university has called safety concerns. These protests, as soon as they began, almost immediately shifted from a focus on civil rights solely to an argument over free speech. College campuses have for hundreds of years been fertile soil for protest, resistance, and sometimes progress. But there can also be unintended consequences. And for proof, some historians say we just need to look back in time. One of those historians is Stephen Mintz, professor of history at UT Austin, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Pleasure to be with you.
So the piece that you wrote, you have actually written a lot about campus protests over the years. And the one that caught our attention was one where the headline was, "Are pro-Palestinian student protests helping or hurting their cause?" So let's start, if you would, just give us a short explanation, your possibly unpopular opinion. Why is it that you think that these student protests might be hurting the cause?
The student protests of the late 1960s and the early 1970s brought many positive changes to campus. But the most powerful and profound consequence was 40 years of conservative ascendancy. It was the protests of the 1960s that brought Ronald Reagan to national attention, that helped elect S.I. Hayakawa as California's U.S. Senator. In other words, without careful strategy, it is very possible to trigger a backlash that will last for decades.
So, I mean, you're not an anti-protest person. So I want to kind of be very careful about what careful strategy means for you, because there have one could say that it's not the students who have turned the current protests into sort of a nightmare of violence and all these images of police officers dragging students down. One could argue that that has been because of the reactions of these administrations. So when you say careful strategy, what do you mean?
In the early 1970s, there were 2,500 bombings in the United States. most of them were perpetrated by right-wing paramilitary groups. But the public perception was that they were perpetrated largely by the Weathermen and other left-wing groups. The way protests are depicted makes a huge difference. One of the goals of the leadership of the protest movements of the 1960s was to build coalitions that extended well beyond the campus. And figures like Martin Luther King played a crucial role in doing their best to eliminate provocateurs from the protests, because they understood that media will focus on the most sensational statements and episodes, and that those can be very destructive.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned Dr. King, because he was widely criticized by the majority of white Americans at the time for, quote, hurting the Negro cause of civil rights. He was widely disapproved of. By the time he died, 3 out of 4 white Americans disapproved of him and felt he was protesting the wrong way, and that he was doing more to harm his cause than help it. Isn't that similar to what you're saying about these students?
My read of history is that you need realistic, practical, actionable goals, and you need coalitions that include labor, that include the churches, and that include others if you really want to be effective. Otherwise, the perception by the public will be that the protests are entirely performative. They're narcissistic, and they're not really aimed at bringing about improvements for the people supposedly that you're trying to help.
I mean, but since we're going to go back in history, we can look at a number of times when students protested entirely on their own, without finding partnerships, or protested first and then the partnerships came later from other groups who said, we agree with you, so we will join. And you can go well back in history. You can go back to the Fisk University protests of 1925, which actually resulted in a lot of positive change. You can look back to the White Rose, which was a resistance group in Nazi Germany, so in the 1940s. So, you know, although the ideal situation might be for protests to have partners off campus, I think it's fair to say that older people are almost always going to look at college students and assume that they're being difficult. I mean, that's just a stereotype, don't you think?
Think of what the goals were for the majority of the late 1960s campus protesters. They were calling for an end to the military draft. They succeeded. They were calling for an end to American involvement in Vietnam. They succeeded. They didn't do this on their own. They did it because they were able to shift public opinion. And while there were plenty of disruptive incidents, while there were plenty of provocations, their goal was to forge unity among right people, thinking people, in order to bring about some fundamental changes in policy. Now, their goals may have seemed utopian at the time, but in fact, they were realistic. And I think it is crucial that there be clear leadership for these movements on campus, and that they have practical, realistic, actionable aims.
I just interviewed a protester from Columbia who's at the campus in Columbia, and they do have a list of actionable demands. I mean, there are things like divesting from anything that supports Israel's war machine, and that can take time, and that's very complicated. I remember hearing those similar demands when people asked universities to divest from anything connected to South Africa because of apartheid. But these protests didn't start on campus either, right? I mean, we already had protests from large Jewish groups in Washington, D.C. I took the metro down and watched them in Los Angeles, in New York. We've had a number of protests, and you could say that the students are linking in with an existing robust resistance. I wonder if you agree with that, or if you think that inherently these protests that are happening on campus are different.
The protests that are occurring on campus today bear some resemblance to the protests of the late 1960s, but they differ in some really fundamental ways. For one thing, there was far greater unity among students in the late 1960s because the issue of the military draft was viewed by most young people as an existential issue. For every man, it meant signing up for the draft. And for every woman, it was a brother or a boyfriend or someone else they knew who might be headed into war. On campuses today, even though the scale of the demonstration seems quite large, as a percentage of the student population, it's relatively small. These are unlike the protests that shut down virtually every university campus in 1970 following the American incursion into Cambodia. Now, these protests differ in other ways as well. For the most part, the protests of the late 1960s were entirely student-directed. There were a few faculty members who were supportive, but faculty were running scared because they knew they could be stripped of tenure for abetting protests. And some were dismissed from their jobs, including the very famous historian, Eugene Genovese. And students today are getting a lot more support from staff members than was ever the case in the late 1960s. My own view is that student protests are best handled when they're student-directed, so that students make sure that they take responsibility for seeing that the ends are achieved, and also that they can engage a much more diverse student body.
Okay, so we need to take a break, but there is still a lot to talk about. We're talking with Stephen Mintz about the student protests going on against the war in Gaza, and we will continue to talk in just a moment, so stay with us. This is Hear Me Out.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Jerusalem Demsis. I'm a writer at The Atlantic. And my beat, in many ways, is to challenge the conventional wisdom. I've written about how the problem with local democracy might just be too much voting, about how some environmental laws actually squash green energy development, and about how maybe the big demographic question of the day isn't overpopulation, but underpopulation. My new show is called Good on Paper. It questions what we really know about popular narratives with a new guest every Tuesday. Find and follow Good on Paper from The Atlantic, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. This podcast is all about spicy opinions with which you may not automatically agree, or you may automatically agree, and finding a space to talk about it in a smart an informed and honest way. And that's definitely what we're doing today, because I know a lot of you listeners have a lot of strong opinions, not just about what's happening in Gaza, but about the protests that are happening on campuses all across the United States. So I encourage you to listen to what our guest is saying with an open mind, and understanding that we're all here for the same reason, which is to make a better world, I hope, anyway. But in any case, just before the break, Professor Mintz was talking about having protests be student-directed and how that's better in the end. And I would have to push back here, Stephen, because all these comparisons to the 1960s aren't really exact. I would say, first of all, from the students that I've spoken to, I don't think they want to recreate what happened in the 60s. I think they see that as an inspiration, but they are feel as though they are fundamentally different. I would also say that if you look back to many of those protests in the 1960s, you see a lot of organizers and activists from outside of campus, some older, some not, coming in and helping these students, inspiring them. Sometimes they came on campus and gave speeches and then helped to organize protests or joined in with the protests. Looking back from our vantage point now, you know, maybe there was the difference in percentage of student-led ones, but it's that to me feels like a nitpicking. I think that there have always been people from outside of campus who have helped to organize protests. Have there not?
One difference, I think, between then and now is that our campuses, including the wealthiest and most select campuses in America, are much more fragile and much more vulnerable than we generally think. And the opposition does not come entirely from the right. We also see it on the left. Let me give you a few examples of that. In Massachusetts, there are legislators who have proposed taxing the endowments of the wealthy private universities, and not in a symbolic way, but in a very substantive way. In a variety of cities across the country, there are calls to tax university property. There are also calls to tax ancillary income by these campuses. Already, we're seeing a sharp drop in donor donations. These institutions, as wealthy as they appear, are in fact very financially vulnerable. And there's a real danger, in my view, that we could see these institutions crippled. Their leadership is caught in a bind. They can't do anything right now without large numbers of complaints from the left and from the right. I wouldn't want to be in one of those jobs right now, but I think there's a real danger that our higher educational system could come out of this.
I think my thoughts on what you just said are that I think I would partially agree with what you're saying, except I do think universities are in a much more precarious position than many people realize, but they have been for a really long time. Funding for universities has decreased consistently. If you look at that graph, the line just keeps going down and down and down and down and down. And so they do rely more on their alumni. They do rely more on philanthropists and private donors and corporate donors. So I think that there's always a question about, will universities be able to keep the doors open? On the other hand, isn't that what's fueling what could be called an overreaction to these protests on the part of administrators? I mean, there is a world in which these protests began and administrators said, okay, protest is a regular part of college life. We're going to set aside this area of the quad for the protests. Here's the rules. You got to keep it clean, blah, 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 blah. And if you don't, then whoever is littering or doing whatever you're doing, or if there's any kind of violence, we will handle that. But we will just make space for this protest. There is a world in which that could have happened rather than calling in law enforcement to make arrests. And it's possibly exactly what you're talking about, this financial position that spurred the fear, that spurred the overreaction.
You know, we have, for a variety of reasons, a lot of unseasoned administrators at our universities right now.
That I can fully agree with. We finally found something we absolutely agree with here,
Steve. The average professional lifespan of a college president has gone down and down and down, and it's about 5 years or even less. But many of the leaders at our most prestigious institutions, they're brand new on the job. They do not have a lot of experience handling these kind of protests and figuring out how to make accommodations, how to negotiate, how to work with students, and how to build a consensus on campus. This is a real problem. And I guess they'll live and learn. And if they don't live and learn, they'll be out.
Yes.
Campuses need kind of leadership, and that has to come from faculty as well as from senior administrators to figure out how to navigate a really difficult political environment. The problem is public faith in higher education has diminished radically, and while it's diminished less among Democrats, the confidence in higher ed among independents has also gone down steeply. Now, that's not a good situation for the future of higher education. And then there's deeper problems. Our campuses are having trouble preparing students for well-paying, secure jobs. You know, about 40% of our college graduates wind up in a job that doesn't require their major, and in many cases doesn't even require a college degree. There are real problems facing our campuses, and this is not in any way to minimize the problems that are occurring in the Middle East, but it is to say that this is an all-hands-on-deck challenge that campuses, including students, need to address.
I agree with 90% of what you just said, but I don't think any of those issues are something that students can address. I don't think we can make the connection between students protesting and the decrease in trust in higher education. Part of the decrease in trust in our higher education came from exactly what you're talking about, the fact that you can't even get into the door in some places for a job interview unless you have that degree on your resume, despite the fact that the job may not even need that kind of degree. It partly comes from the fact that because of the decrease in funding, students are taking on a massive amount of debt, which they cannot get rid of no matter what. It usually comes with a very high interest rate because that's what we've allowed late stage capitalism to do to our students. So they're paying on it for years and years and years, and yet they'll find out 15 years later they owe more than they did when they began paying. That decreases our trust in higher education. Also, another thing that decreases the trust in higher education is the opposite of these student protests. It's the way that there is a tangible difference between how conservative complaints are handled on universities, partly defensive. I mean, universities are always sensitive to claims that they are liberal, which I think they should just get over and stop trying to defend themselves from that claim. But there is a measurable difference between the way that conservative protest is handled on campus versus liberal protest. And by the way, I mean, just to go back to your earlier thing about how the protests of the 60s were more universal, I mean, that's not true. Baby boomers say that only about 1 in 5 of them ever participated in any demonstration whatsoever, and only about 3% of of boomers in the 1960s said that they were activists. On the other hand, the conservative group, and you mentioned this already, but the conservative activists, the conservative protesters outnumbered them in bounds. And again, you mentioned this already, but it should be remembered that there is a group called the Young Americans for Freedom that they were demanding that the U.S. invade Cuba, I think, and go in and militarily take down the Berlin Wall. They had a massive number of members and had protests everywhere. I just think that to try to blame the poor view of higher education on student protesters is not fair at all.
American higher education rests on a democratic promise that we have violated. That democratic process is that any student with the ability should be able to go to a college that will help them achieve their full potential. But as you know, as well as I know, our colleges are among the most stratified institutions in America. And while our highly selective institutions have admitted more people from the bottom half of the income distribution, it is nowhere near half of their student body. With tuition and fees running close to $100,000 a year, at an institution like Yale, the last time I saw the statistics, more than half of the student body could pay full freight for their education. At public universities like mine or other major public institutions, their student bodies bear no resemblance to the student demographics of the same college-going age. We need much more concern, it seems to me, about these issues of inequality in our higher education system than we're seeing. There are many big problems in the world, many of which are going to be hard to change. But there's no question in my mind that the problems on our campuses are susceptible to change if students will prioritize those as high consequential issues.
So we have to take another break, and it's good to take a break here because I would agree. I think inequality is probably the number one problem in the world. So let's take a break on agreement, and we'll be back in just a moment continuing this conversation with Professor Stephen Mintz about college campus protests. I'm Celeste Headlee, and you are listening to Hear Me Out.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Good to have you back. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. I'm Celeste Headlee, and we're talking about the college protests today. We ended just a moment ago with our esteemed guest saying that students should be protesting inequality and the stratification of universities. And I think, Stephen, I agree with that. My instinct is to say there probably have been protests about that. They may not have been as widespread as what we're seeing right now. But I gotta say, I'm in my 50s now, and I have to constantly fight myself to not make assumptions about younger people. I have to fight myself to not fall into the trap of criticizing Gen Z for liking avocado toast or something. And I wonder if you and I and many of our colleagues need to be careful about how we view the young people who are protesting today. You know, I read a piece in Politico from someone saying that the protests of the 1960s were more noble because students were protesting, demanding freedom from the shackles of supervision. And these students today are doing the opposite. They're demanding that faculty create a home. And they went on to say that they're trying to force universities to create a home where they can continue to be children. And the first thing I thought was, yeah, that's completely not true. And that's condescending to the extreme. I'm not saying your piece is not condescending. This guy's was. But I will say that I have to constantly, you know, be careful that I am not trying to act in loco parentis, that I am not being paternal towards younger people and immediately telling them how they should do their protests. Do you worry about this for yourself? Do you think about, okay, I need to make sure I'm not, you know, trying to school these kids?
In the late 1960s, Michael Harrington, key figure in the old left, was highly critical of student protesters. And in looking back, it's obvious that he fell into a trap that you're discussing. His wildest dream had come true, and he couldn't see it in front of his own eyes, right? He was critical of the very people who were fulfilling his democratic vision. And that kind of blindside is very widespread. But the fact is that you, and maybe me, have experiences that we should share with younger activists, and we have advice and suggestions that they are free to take or not take, but that are based on hard-won personal experience. You, but certainly I, lived for 40 years of backlash that was precipitated in part by the protests of on campuses in the late 1960s. And that is from the election of Richard Nixon through the presidency of George W. Bush. And while there were two Democratic presidents in between, Carter and Clinton, they were pretty conservative Democratic presidents. 40 years was an awful high price to pay.
I have to wonder if it's fair to put those 40 years on student protests. I mean, I think that's saying a lot, Stephen. I gotta say, there are so many things that led to the 40 years of conservative rule, not least of which, I mean, I absolutely agree with a lot of what you're saying. Clinton was a very conservative president. I would say that Barack Obama was fairly middle of the road. He was definitely not liberal. But I think that we can owe that more to racism, misogyny, and the Southern strategy than we do to student protests. I mean, part of the reason why student protests often make people so angry is because a lot of people in power don't take them seriously. They see these as kids who are acting out.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment.
Yes, that's the whole point of
and
the show.
The real effect of student culture in the 1960s was the counterculture. And when I look at my students today, they look just like you or I did decades ago. They wear jeans, they wear t-shirts, they wear sandals, or they wear gym shoes. They look nothing like the students as late as 1964 or 1965. That counterculture reshaped this country's values in fundamental and incredibly positive ways. probably hard to imagine a world where society was negative towards a mother working. It is hard to imagine a world where the American Psychiatric Association would have considered anyone who was gay or lesbian mentally defective. That was the world that the counterculture was fighting in the late 1960s and 1970s. And on that front, the counterculture won overwhelmingly. Insofar we are a better society today, it's because those values ultimately won out. And what concerns me right now is that utopian strain isn't so apparent in these protests. That vision of a society built around love, which we can't even say these days without a hint of snark and irony, those ideas were so important in transforming American society because it was a vision of human liberation. And that vision is what I want to see the protesters also embrace. Here, let me go a little further and dig my hole a little further. I am not in the business of supporting organizations that are anti-gay and lesbian. I am not in the business of supporting activists who support groups who engage in murder of civilians. I hope that we can all share a higher vision. And insofar as we oppose American policy in the Middle East, it is to bring about a world of liberation in the cultural sense, in the sense of fundamental values that stresses equality. And I fear very much that that utopian vision is getting lost, not just because the media is distorting the protests, but because the protesters themselves have not been as clear as they need to be about their vision.
So we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to give you the last word. But before, let me I just want to push back on this idea. I mean, I feel like this has become my repeated sentence in the over the course of this, which is that I agree with nearly everything that you just said, and passionately put and articulately. But let me quote you from a piece from a journalist I admire named Hamilton Nolan. He said, "The protest encampments in support of Gaza that are sweeping elite college campuses across the nation and being ruthlessly crushed by riot cops at the same rate are valuable arenas of political education, more valuable than anything these kids will learn in the classroom. These experiences will teach these kids some of the most important truths they need to know to accurately assess the way America operates, that the polished people in charge of things are often merciless dictators at heart. That awful atrocities will be tolerated as soon as they can be ignored. That 1 millimeter beneath the smile of the boss lurks gritted teeth and a determination to call the cops to break your head open if you don't listen. To have young people set out to protest the deaths of tens of thousands of civilians and be met by hysterical repression from the same institutions that have been tasked with making them, quote, good citizens, is one of the best lessons I can imagine." And I guess to me that resonates because it brings me back to where we started, which is that I agree that the protests are bothering a lot of Americans. I agree that these protests will be used by members of the lowercase c conservative right to further damage the reputation of universities. On the other hand, I think protests, in order to be effective, are always uncomfortable and unpopular. And I also think that many of the bad consequences can't be put on these students. I think the students are doing, to their minds, the ethical thing. And they're doing it pretty bravely. I mean, they know in some of these campuses what might happen, and they're doing it anyway. And I feel proud of them.
My view is that if they hope to alter the nature of power in America, then they need to absorb some practical political lessons. And those practical political lessons means speaking outside of campus to ordinary Americans. It means addressing ordinary Americans' concerns. It means not treating yourself as having special insight because you're in a select university. It means coalition building. And that's what I'm not seeing. And if you want to bring about long-term change, which I think is the goal, then you have to be willing to do the hard work of organizing off campus.
It's fair enough. I know that we are going to get letters. People have strong opinions on this issue. So I look forward to hearing what everyone has to say. And I really appreciate your coming here to give us the benefit of your experience and your knowledge and keeping this conversation in the public discourse, because I think it's important. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We always want to know what you think, but in this case, we really want to know what you think. Because look, a protest is only as powerful or weak according to how many people agree and get activated as a result. So we would love to get your views of what is happening on college campuses, and especially what our guest was talking about, a comparison with protests of the past. So email us. It's hearmeout@slate.com. Last week, we had Bernard Tomas on the show to argue that third parties have more influence on our elections than you might think. It was a thought-provoking conversation. And before we go today, we want to share one of your thoughts. A listener named Anissa wrote to us and said this: "Yes, I believe in third parties in theory, but I'm too scared of what will happen in the meantime. I regret voting for Ralph Nader in my first presidential election, 2000. I woke up to the results the next morning feeling like an idiot. Yes, I was in California, so it didn't really matter, but if Gore had gotten 2 million additional votes and won the popular vote by a larger margin, wouldn't we be just that much closer to dissolving the Electoral College by now? Another lesson from that fiasco is that we have to keep fighting and keep counting every vote." Thank you, Anissa. And I agree with you entirely on all things. I believe in third parties. I think we need them. And I also am afraid to vote for them. Again, we really love to hear from you. So please let us know what you're on your mind. It's hearmeout@slate.com. Hear Me Out is a podcast from Slate. The show is produced by Maura Curry. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio. I am your host, Celeste Headley. Until next time, speak your mind, but keep it open.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.